Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Craig Mullaney grew up blue-collar, Irish Catholic, straight arrow, West Point Rhodes Scholar, to become part of the backbone of the young U.S. Army Officer Corps in Afghanistan. Now, as Barack Obama is hammering out strategy for the Afghan war, Mullaney is telling his story of books and bullets, of vaccinating camels, and of the battlefield. This hour, On Point, the education of an American soldier and what to do in Afghanistan now. You can join the conversation. What are your hopes and fears for the future of the war in Afghanistan? What's your experience on the Afghan front? And what advice would you give to President Obama? Joining me now from New York is Craig Mullaney, a Rhode Island boy who graduated number two in his class at West Point in 2000, an elite Army Ranger, chosen as a Rhodes Scholar to study at Oxford, spent 9 months deployed as a platoon leader in Afghanistan, came home a U.S. Army captain, and worked for Barack Obama in his presidential campaign. The rumor is he'll work for Obama again soon at the Pentagon. His new memoir is The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education. It's had rave reviews from everyone from Generals David Petraeus and Wesley Clark to journalists Joe Klein and Ahmed Rashid, who calls it the three cups of tea of soldiering. Craig Mullaney, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
You're a young guy to be writing a memoir. What did you set out to do here? You're telling a story of education, of time at Oxford and around the world, falling in love, marrying a beautiful young woman from India, going off to soldier in Afghanistan. But most of all, you seem to be writing in a way for soldiers. What's the message you want to get across?
Well, in a way, I don't think I wrote this book. I think the book wrote me. I returned and I had a lot of the war still left with me, and I started writing as a way of making sense of that experience. And I never thought I'd publish it until I was encouraged by a friend that this story would be one that would hold value for both my peers in the service, those who are still fighting, and for my students. When I was teaching at the Naval Academy, I wanted to pass on the lessons I'd learned the hard way so that they'd come back intact physically and mentally, and they'd bring their men back. And I think at a very personal level, I dedicated the book to my brother, who was 7 years behind me at West Point. And this was my opportunity to put in words everything I thought would help him as he began his own career, headed off to Iraq, and then probably next year to Afghanistan.
We're going to get onto the battlefield there with you. You have some riveting accounts of it, but you've also got a lot about that training at West Point and beyond on your way there. You went to West Point before 9/11, but you've got a good sense of who's coming into the military these days, who's looking to be in the officer corps. What's the profile? With all the casualties that we've taken, Afghanistan now over 580 in the Afghanistan region, U.S. military casualties there. Who's signing up among young Americans? Who's putting their hand up at West Point and elsewhere for this kind of service?
Well, I think they're part of a larger movement of young Americans who've come of age since 9/11 who look around the world and see its challenges and want to make a difference. And West Point and the Army, the military, is one of those ways that you can very clearly have an impact on your country and on the world. I think the particular profile of someone who heads to West Point is someone who's looking for an incredible challenge. No matter how gifted you are as a student or as an athlete, there's something at West Point that's bound to break you, something that's going to force you to fail and to become stronger. I think it attracts the type of person who's looking for adventure. Coming from Rhode Island, I grew up in an admittedly small world, and I wanted to see so much more. And West Point and the Army opened my eyes to these great adventures. I think it's that combination of service and adventure and of challenge that brings most folks into the military.
A Rhodes Scholar, and then you're out on the Afghan-Pakistan border, and the mortar rounds are flying. Did that extra layer of academic exercise, intellectual exercise, work for you or against you? Does it help to be a book-learned, well-tutored soldier? Is it critical? Is it important?
I think it's important. I don't know that it's necessarily critical in a tactical firefight. But I think in the larger context of being deployed in an uncertain, ambiguous environment, the opportunity to study in a foreign country, in a foreign culture, and to really be forced to identify for the first time coming out of West Point my own goals. How was I going to make sense of these 2 years I had at Oxford? Oxford's a very different university than those in the U.S. I didn't have a syllabus. I didn't have a class schedule. In essence, I was handed a library card and told to make the best of 2 years. And so I read deeply. I traveled widely. And I think many of those travels I took, they were the mental equivalent of jumping out of a helicopter, of confronting the unknown and being comfortable in chaos. It's a different type of chaos than a battlefield. But if I think of trying to acclimatize my platoon and myself to this strange environment of Afghanistan, having traveled to Southeast Asia, having traveled to India, prepared me in some sense for confronting that uncertain situation. And if I didn't know the answers, at least asking the right questions.
There are a lot of great characters in this book. One of them is Lieutenant Colonel Paul LaCamera, a battalion commander at Fort Drum in New York. You set out from there to Afghanistan. You call him a kind of Yoda in camouflage. A lot of semi-cryptic one-liners from him. Skill and will win battles, and a whole lot more. You write that he saw no contradiction between intellectual ability and the iron will that he suggested was necessary for warriors. And then this line of advice: be polite, be professional, and be prepared to kill everyone you meet. Did that describe you?
Polite, professional, prepared to kill everyone I meet. Prepared, yes. I think as an officer serving, this is one of the difficulties of the type of environment we're in. You can't necessarily identify your enemies and your friends. No one's wearing a uniform. And so you have this, you need to have a sense of paranoia and a sense that keeps you thinking and keeps you one step ahead. And this, you have this burden on your shoulders of protecting your men. And so paranoia is a very healthy instinct to have in a combat environment. But yet is in tension with the imperative to be open to the population, to look for friends, to let your guard down. And balancing those two is one of the hardest things any soldier has to do today.
We're going to go onto the battlefield with you, but I want to get a sense of where things have been since you got back in 2004 from Afghanistan. You ended up on the campaign plane with candidate Barack Obama, still maybe in your 20s, advising this candidate. There's a rumor out there now, maybe you can tell us, that you're maybe nominated to be Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Central Asia. That would put you right in the middle of the Pentagon Obama-Afghanistan effort now. How did you get connected with Barack Obama?
I met a wonderful man named Dennis McDonough a few years ago, and we met at a dinner, became good friends. He'd help me bring students from the Naval Academy to show them around Capitol Hill, to bring them around Washington and meet some of these policymakers, so that they'd have a better sense of how the military connected with different parts of our government. He ended up being one of the chief advisors to President-elect, candidate Obama. Mm-hmm. And when my time in the Army was drawing to a close and I looked for my next opportunity to serve, President Obama, I found a candidate I could really believe in. And I asked my friend Dennis if there was an opportunity for me to work. He said, I'll work anywhere. I'll look at envelopes. He said, well, you know, actually, we'd love to have you come out to Chicago and be on the team. I think your voice is an important one to add to the discussion. And so 10 days after I left the Army, I was in Chicago. And 2 days after that, I was on a plane to Colorado with President Obama.
Or candidate at that point.
Candidate Obama.
What did he want to know from you?
I think he wanted to know from me, you know, maybe some of what he wouldn't get from, you know, an elder statesman. The texture of fighting on the ground. I think there's a lot of wisdom in the sergeants and the lieutenants, captains and majors of this war who are there where the rubber meets the road. And I wanted to talk to him about, you know, what are the limits and the opportunities for ground forces? What are the things we can do? What are the things we can't do? And in my experience in 2003, I wanted to give him a sense of how thinly spread on the ground we were and the challenges that that presented, and how we often felt like we were operating without a strategy and without the resources we needed to accomplish our mission. And so, I think he took that to heart.
The top American commander in Afghanistan now, General David McKiernan, was talking in Washington last week about the situation there, and especially in southern Afghanistan. He said, where we are at best stalemated, at best stalemated. Are we winning? Are we losing in Afghanistan? We'll talk about the details, but what's your bottom line?
Well, I think in a counterinsurgency, if you're not winning, you're losing. It's not enough to stalemate. Time is on the side of the insurgent. There's an Afghan proverb that says, you may have all the watches, but we have all the time. That they can, in a sense, wait you out. It's far more expensive to wage a counterinsurgency than to wage an insurgency. And so eventually, if we don't turn the situation around, it exhausts our will to continue the enterprise.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with a young Afghan war veteran about his experience on the battlefront. You can hear some of it behind me right there. And his advice for Barack Obama on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the conflict there. Craig Mullaney is my guest, former U.S. Army captain. Number two in his class at West Point, a Rhodes Scholar, Army Ranger, deployed to Afghanistan as a platoon leader in 2003 and 2004. He's out with a new memoir called The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education. What about this Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Central Asia? Is that real? Is that formal? What can you tell us? Anything? Will it be you?
I mean, I haven't been offered anything. I'd obviously be honored to serve in the administration on an issue that's so near to my heart. And you'll be the first to know, Tom, if I find out.
I'm sure I will. We just heard the incoming rocket fire there from a video of your time at a fire base in Afghanistan. Set the scene for us. When and where was that? What was going on?
Yeah, you shocked me a little bit with that. It brought me right back to the moment. It was in November of 2003, and that was at a base called Orgun in a central part of Paktika province on the border with Pakistan. And it was the middle of the afternoon. I was, at that point, working on the staff of the battalion. So I was behind a keyboard instead of a Humvee. Mm-hmm. And you hear these rockets begin to come in, and I sort of put my helmet on, continue typing, because unfortunately there's very little that you can do under those circumstances. It's one of the frustrations of serving in Afghanistan and Iraq. I think when you have these, they would call an indirect fire attack, you often don't know where it's coming from, and you can strike back, but it often comes at great risk, because if the insurgent is smart, they'll fire rockets from a heavily populated area, and so any reprisal would probably create more enemies than it's worth. But those rockets came in, fortunately, and no one was hurt. One landed within 100 meters of where we ate dinner and lunch every day. So you can go outside and you pick up the shrapnel and sort of cross myself and thank God that I wasn't injured.
It's rough terrain. You quote a Gunnery Sergeant Oaks saying, use the mountains or they will use you.
So true, especially in Afghanistan. The valley floor, we were a half mile above Denver. And then the mountain soared another couple thousand feet above that. And so when you first arrive, it's labor just to walk around wearing all the equipment you have, let alone moving quickly on a battlefield under stress.
And the mountains will use you. And these are all the details of staying below the ridge line, so you can't be easily picked off. You can't avoid the mountains, though. And ultimately, you describe in great detail on one stretch called Lozano Ridge, a battle that I think you've recounted to help educate upcoming young officers about what they may expect in Afghanistan. I wish you'd set the scene and give us a sense of that day and how your education as a young soldier came into play in that battle. Where was it? When was it? Set the scene.
This was on a day I'll never forget, September 29th, 2003. It was a beautiful, beautiful day in the fall. Another platoon in the company was out on patrol, and they began to take some mortar fire from just inside Pakistan. And they returned fire and called for reinforcements. And so my platoon quickly moved out the gates as the reinforcements to second platoon. And we arrived, and we were on this bluff overlooking Lozano Ridge in the middle ground, stretching like a Louisville slugger from south to north. Mm-hmm. And the only place you could get up on the ridge was from the south. And behind Lozano Ridge, this like sort of jagged edges of glass, is Pakistan and these Pakistani observation posts. I mean, we were right on the border,
smack up against the border.
Mm-hmm. And I moved my platoon down into this valley, and then up onto Lozano Ridge. And I was with several Humvees, these gun trucks, moving along the ridge. And I had a squad of infantry on foot moving between Lozano Ridge and the Pakistani border. And just as we were almost at the end of Lozano Ridge, about ready to complete our sweep, my lead squad leader down in the low ground on foot noticed some trash, Snickers bar, some burned out logs. And he was suspicious. Mm-hmm. And then he saw footprints leading back towards Pakistan. And he feared that if he continued with his men down this valley, that they were walking into an ambush. And so he redirected them, and they started moving up a hill. And as they move up this hill, the lead soldier, Sergeant Grenz, mm-hmm. notices three men hidden in a bush with their hands on, like this old-style plunge detonator. Mm-hmm. Like you've seen Wile E. Coyote with. And he realizes that this detonation device is connected somewhere up underwear on top of Lozano Ridge where I am with the trucks. He shoots the men in the tree. I think he killed one and wounded the other two. And as soon as that happened, it was like the entire ridge lit up like a concert, flashes everywhere. And we were taking incredible amounts of incoming fire. And in that opening salvo, Private First Class Evan O'Neill, a 19-year-old from Haverhill, Mass., mm-hmm. near Utah, mm-hmm. he was killed. And the first report I get in this contact is from Sergeant McGurk, that squad leader, and said, I've got a KIA, killed in action.
This was the first death under your command as an Army officer.
It was. And it was also really the first test of my leadership in a combat environment, what I'd trained for 4 years at West Point, through Ranger School, through continual training at Fort Drum, to answer that question, what do we do now, sir? Mm-hmm. And it falls on your shoulder to make that decision. And I didn't know whether I should move down into the low ground near where McGurk was? Mm-hmm. Do I stay on the high ground where I've got better visibility and can direct the heavy firepower? And I made the decision to stand my ground where I was. And I really wrestled with that decision for years afterwards. Should I have gone down? Was there something I had done wrong in maneuvering my forces to begin with that had put Private O'Neill in a vulnerable position? Was I responsible for his death? And so that's something it's a lot harder to train. I mean, you can train a lieutenant to make the right tactical decisions, but how do you train a lieutenant, a sergeant, to deal with losing one of your own and having to go back out again 2 days later over the same ground? That's a level of resolve that it's hard.
Things got more complicated when you began to take fire from the Pakistan side of the border, from the Pakistan Military Observation Post, it appeared. We'll look at that, but let me get a couple of calls here first. From New York City, David is calling. David, you're on the air with Craig Mullaney.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How you doing, Captain Mullaney?
Hi, David.
Hey, I just wanted to say I read your book, and I was a squad leader in the Marine Corps, and I served in the War on Terror, and I just want to let you know that I thought it was a fantastic depiction of a leader having to, you know, wrestle with some of those decisions and living with it after the fact. And, you know, I think we've chatted before and a little bit, and I just want to say congratulations, and I thought it was a phenomenal account.
The details rang true to you, David?
Without a doubt, you know, and I think just the decisions of are you prepared, the contemplating, you know, no matter how. I think the biggest point that I took away, which I felt myself during my time in the Marine Corps, was, you know, no matter how much I prepare, will I ever really, regardless of all that preparation, what things that can happen that are beyond your control and that far exceed, you know, the expectation of what prepared is. And I think that was one thing that I took away from the book. And I picked up the book when it first came out, and I read it basically in 2 days. And, you know, it's just it's an unbelievable story. And I think it's fantastic. And I think that, you know, as a veteran as well, just that book helped cope with some of the things that I had thought through during my service.
It's a pretty great read. David, thanks for your call. Craig Mullaney, did you feel prepared? Are we preparing our young officers adequately, more than adequately? I mean, you'd had West Point, Army Ranger School, Rhodes Scholar in Oxford, for heaven's sakes. Did you have what you needed?
I couldn't have asked for any better preparation for the Army at the time. I think we've made incredible improvements over the last 8 years since I left West Point. I mean, they're doing some amazing things there now. I'm going to go and visit tomorrow. I look forward to meeting with cadets who joined an academy knowing they'd be going to war. And I think that changes, maybe that changes your absorption rate of knowledge while you're going through the institution. But I don't know that anyone can ever truly be ready. That was a conclusion that I reached in trying to pass on to my brother Gary what it was I learned. And I was asked by my students repeatedly, were you ready? I said, I was ready as I could be, but you can never fully be ready.
You pushed out from Fort Drum. We've got a call from Fort Drum. Mike, you're on the air with Craig Mullaney.
Hi, Craig. I was right now, I'm actually serving as a rifle platoon leader in 187 Infantry.
Cool.
I think, to the top. I guess self-preparation essentially for my view, and most of the PLs that I served with in our last tour in Iraq was really what got us prepared for the environment that we're going in. However, one of the big problems that I ran into was actually trying to break it down to really the squad leader and below, you know, the junior enlisted soldiers, on exactly what the mission was. And now that there's starting to be a focus, I mean, we had COIN academies and whatnot, but a lot of
COIN, counterinsurgency, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
We had that particular training, and it's pretty good for at least the officer corps and platoon and company level. We get quite a bit of that, but trying to implement that and have our soldiers buy into the idea of counterinsurgency, and, you know, in effect, I mean, putting yourself in a vulnerable position out in sector, but trying to achieve an end state that is conducive for, you know, rebuilding a country and whatnot. So I guess my question for you, Craig, would be like, how would you as a junior leader going into Afghanistan before there was a counterinsurgency, how would you now, with your experience, be able to provide those junior enlisted and squad leaders with the idea of, you know, how to buy into the counterinsurgency philosophy?
Captain Mullaney?
Yeah, that's a great question. How do you teach this? And how do you shift philosophy? Because it's
from, you know, what so to long, what?
Yeah, I think for a long time, the orientation, at least of the Army, I can only speak from that experience, was enemy oriented. You focused on finding, killing, or capturing your enemy. And that's a part of what you do in a counterinsurgency, and that's a part of what needs to be done in Afghanistan. But the much more difficult thing is to reorient and say it's about protecting the population. It's about making them feel safe. Because in an insurgency, it's a contest between the government and the insurgent for the political allegiance of the civilian population. They want to know who's going to keep them safe, who's going to give them opportunity, who can they trust, who's going to stay the longest. And I think the answer to that question has to be the Afghan government, supported by the international community. I mean, we're a part of that. We're used to taking the lead. And, you know, there's this kind of this saying in counterinsurgency that if your host country, having the local forces do a job at a mediocre is better than American forces doing a perfect mission. It's about building up that host nation capacity, the ability of Afghan security forces to take the lead. They're naturally better at protecting their own people. They speak the language. They understand the communities. They have the trust. They're not seen as an occupying force. But we have a long way to go to building up those forces. I mean, they're only a quarter of the size of the security forces in Iraq. And Iraq is a smaller, less populous country. So we've got our work cut out for us. I think, to get back to your question, looking at how you prepare for your next deployment, expect to do everything by, with, and through Afghan forces and mentoring and building them so you put yourself out of a job.
But we read so much about corruption in the Afghan government, about heroin and heroin money underwriting so much of what goes on there, about warlords and sympathies that bleed over toward the Taliban. I'm looking at a new poll here out from ABC News and the BBC and German television. You know, with Afghan hearts and minds seem to be sort of slipping away. It showed in 2005, just after you were there, 83% of Afghans had a favorable opinion of the United States. Today, 47%. 68% said the U.S. was performing well, now 32%. 67% said that people supported Western forces in their local area, now 37%. What's going on?
Well, Tom, I mean, you get what you pay for. We've spent the last 7 years not paying much attention to Afghanistan, and I think you've seen a gradual deterioration. For those of us, I'm sure many of the listeners who've stayed tuned in for the last 7 years, you've watched a steady increase in violence. You've watched a deterioration of people feeling secure and a lack of trust in both international forces and in the Afghan government. And it's going to be a hard task to reverse that tide, but it's one that we have to do. But I think when you talk about corruption, I don't think you see that corruption in the Afghan National Army. I mean, that's one of the most trusted institutions in the state. It's not divided along sectarian lines. They're eager to fight. They are looking for resources. They want to learn. Afghan police forces, different story. You may need to reboot entirely. And I think, you know, drugs is certainly a corrupting influence in the country. The new ambassador to Afghanistan, retired Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry, says the biggest enemy the biggest problem isn't a strong enemy. It's a weak state. We have to work to fix that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a young Afghan war veteran about his experience on the battlefront and his advice for Barack Obama. Craig Mullaney is with us. His new memoir is The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education. A little sound there behind us from Shkind Fire Base in Afghanistan, where Mr. Mullaney, lieutenant, captain, got into a boxing match with senior officer Major Paul Wiley. Friendly, bloody. Mullaney had thought that the major had taunted him for his bookishness and Oxford education. He's a Rhodes Scholar, number 2 in his class at West Point. in a pretty good tussle right there with the commanding officer passing time on the war front. His new memoir has had all kinds of accolades from those in the Army, in the military, and beyond. He joins us this hour from New York. You talk about vaccinating camels. You talk about firefights. Here you're in a boxing match. What were you doing?
It's the only boxing match I ever won, incidentally.
Got a little bloody around the lips and nose there. By the way, there's video at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can also read an excerpt of The Unforgiving Minute there. Why were you guys duking it out? Was it that dull? You needed something to do? Beat on each other?
It was my company commander's birthday, and so he was a sports aficionado, and he wanted to have a day of blowing off steam, and so we had this big kind of circle out there, and you could call anyone out and box them in front of the whole company. And, you know, as you described, I think Major Willie thought I had a chip on my shoulder, and he wanted to knock it off. So he challenged me to a fight, and, you know, I had no choice but to accept the challenge, considering my platoon was watching. But Major Willie had, you know, at least 4 inches on me and 40 pounds, and he looked like Cro-Magnon man. He had these scars across his head. He barked orders everywhere. It's generally a fairly grumpy person, and I thought he was going to take all that out on me. And so we step out there, and I'm just wearing, you know, jeans, and this is like was the movie with Tom Cruise where he slugs it out in New York. I'm wearing
in a very dusty kind of, I don't know, fire-based backlot.
No mouthpiece except a piece of cardboard folded up in my mouth.
Oh, that's what that was. We couldn't figure that out.
Yeah, not my teeth falling out. And we just started boxing, and I tried to remember what I'd learned way back as a freshman at West Point in boxing class. It's a mandatory class for everyone, usually right before you go to calculus, so you have a fuzzy head. Anyways, we start boxing, and I'm trying to keep my gloves up to protect my face and jab and hook, and we're going at it. And about halfway through that first round, I went to throw a right hook, and I dislocated my shoulder. I mean, it just ripped out.
Ouch.
And I said, oh well, I'm not going to go down injured. And so I got the referee to help me pop my shoulder back in. And I think the adrenaline just kept me going. And I think I laid a pretty good fight on Major Willie. I didn't knock him down, but I think he looked the worst for wear when we were done.
Did you have a chip on your shoulder bringing your education out there? After all, you were a platoon leader, but you're in your book quoting Kierkegaard and recommending Dostoevsky and Ibsen and Salman Rushdie.
I'll say I was not recommending Rushdie and Ibsen to my soldiers. You know, what happened between the pages of this book wasn't, you know, part of my daily discourse with my platoon. I don't know. I tried to wear my laurels lightly, and it didn't really matter much. My men didn't care whether I had a master's degree from Oxford. They wanted to know that I was going to keep them safe and not make dumb decisions that get them killed. And they needed me to take care of them. And so I had to show that first and foremost. I had to be competent, and I had to care for them. And the rest was just, you know, that was just gravy. I'm not sure why Major Willie had it out for me, and maybe I was reading something into it. I think in my head, Major Willie shared a lot of the similarities with my father. And my father was a foreman in the Providence Gas Company. He's a real blue-collar, hard, callous guy and not a bookish man. And I had a hard time earning his affection and approval. And I was a smart kid, and I also wanted to be the tough kid. And it was nice that after that boxing match, when Major Willie came up and told me, you know, you're smart and you're tough, and you've got to combine the two. And that was something I'd been searching for a long time. And so it was a very important boxing match for me.
A bloody day, but not as bloody as some, and in the end, in good fun. Let's get a call from Jerry in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jerry, you're on the air with Craig Mullaney.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I was in Afghanistan. I was a civil affairs team sergeant. We were in the northern part of the country. Without being too lengthy, I'd like to give the listeners and yourself a little ground truth as to what's going on in Afghanistan and what you're looking at. first of all, these countries are, some of them are part of the old Ottoman Empire. They're not really countries at all. The Brits and so forth drew these boundaries through tribal areas. In Afghanistan, for instance, your Pashtuns are separated from the ones in Pakistan. They don't care about Afghanistan. They want to unite with their brethren. The country of Afghanistan is 14th century. About every 3 to 4 miles, you've got a warlord checkpoint, which is illegal. This is the same sort of thing that held Europe back for centuries, because you had your powers in Europe, robbing people on the roads and these excessive tolls, etc. That's exactly what you see there. Even today, I left in 03. I was in had lunch. My team and I many times with warlords had so many machine guns stacked up around the room couldn't even cover them with the rugs. That's your power in Afghanistan, is the warlords, not Mr. Karzai.
So where are you going with this, Jerry? Are you saying it can't be done, it can't be won, or something else?
Okay, we need to. What we're in the midst of doing is repeating the mistakes we made in Iraq and Vietnam, which is we have a weak central government. They don't control anything around in the countryside. The people know this, so that they know that when we pull out, the only protection they have is ANA, which is still weak. We need, the first thing Mr. Obama needs to do is to cut out the opium traffic. They need to give cash crops to these farmers, which will grow. They will grow other crops if they can make money at it. We're funding our opposition. Okay, we have outside interests that will fund as Syria does in Iraq, the fighting there. We're paying for the fighting by allowing the poppies to be grown. We can see them right beside the road when we go back and forth to the compound.
Mm-hmm.
We're making the same mistakes. We're not. There's no central government there that's strong. When they tell you they control 60 or 70 or whatever, that means a percent of the country. That simply means that you've got some of the warlords sending money into the central government and halfway listening to Mr. Karzai. It does not mean Mr. Karzai controls the country. It's far from it.
Jerry, let us pick it up. You make a powerful case, and it's a tough situation to face. Craig Mullaney, you know, it's been called the graveyard of empires. It didn't work out that way for the British. Well for the British, not well for the Russians. Jerry's painting a pretty tough picture right here, and the suggestion is that this may be undoable. What do you say?
Well, I mean, I'd sort of flip the question around and say, what happens if we don't? I mean, what happens if the Taliban takes over Afghanistan again? What happens if the sanctuary for al-Qaeda is not a very isolated, relatively small part of Pakistan, and it's now all of Afghanistan again? I think that the great mistake that we made after the battles of the Mujahideen, when the Soviets left Afghanistan, was to look the other way. And we did the same thing in 2002, and I don't think we can afford to abandon Afghanistan.
You know, we've talked to Rory Stewart on this show. You've read him, The Places in Between, walked across a good chunk of Afghanistan, served in the British military, and he comes to a different conclusion, or did. He said, you know, this just isn't a place where Western powers should be intervening or can intervene effectively over time. Obama's sending 17,000 more troops in on top of the 38,000 U.S. troops that are there. There's talk of negotiating with some more moderate elements of the Taliban. There was a question earlier we heard from Fort Drum about the mission. Do you see a clear mission here? If you're advising or helping, if you're part of the chorus that's advising the president, what do you say to him about making this a successful effort over time as opposed to something else, something worse? How's it done?
I think in the near term, you have to stabilize a deteriorating security situation so that you can have successful elections in late August. And
for the presidency.
I think Rory's right in that, you know, over the long term, Western intervention is not going to, it doesn't work in that part of the world. But what does work is building up the capacity of the Afghan state and the Afghan security forces and those regional players to make Afghanistan a stable state on some path to economic security, and that it's not again a safe haven for transnational terrorist strikes.
You know, we just heard about the Pakistani government pulling its military out of Swat in northwestern Pakistan. They're essentially conceding it, I guess, to the Taliban, allowing Islamic law to take over there. That looks like another retreat. Many in the U.S. have described it as another retreat.
Well, I don't want to characterize a deal that isn't sort of fully complete, and we don't know how it'll turn out. We know that previous peace negotiations that the Pakistani government has made with Taliban forces in Pakistan they don't honor their side of the bargain. And so that definitely gives me pause when I think about any negotiation. I think when General Petraeus and others talk about reconciliation, I don't think they're talking about cutting deals with Taliban leaders. I think it's about trying to peel off the foot soldiers who oftentimes are only fighting for money and for status. And if there is another way for them to – if they had a viable, legitimate job in a different way of earning the status and respect of their community, mm-hmm. they'd pursue that. And our challenge is to make it easy for the Taliban to quit, for the foot soldiers to quit, give them opportunities to take their life in a different direction. I mean, it's a hard position to be in if you're one of these Afghan villages. And driving around with my platoon, and you look in the eyes of these adolescents, and in many cases, you know there's no hope. And that's the asymmetric weapon of the counterinsurgent and the government. We can provide hope. The U.S., Afghanistan, our international partners, we can build. The Taliban only knows how to destroy.
Let's go to Todd in Buffalo, New York. Todd, you're on the air with Craig Mullamy.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom and Craig. Yeah. I have a son who is a first sergeant with the 10th Mountain there in Afghanistan right now. And I guess I'm battling with some level of misperception. He's very discouraged in relating that he doesn't feel like the U.S. public has a very good grasp on the serious nature or the gravity of what's occurring there. And I can see some parallels when I see the president being very direct and straightforward about the dire straits we're in an economic situation. Do you, Craig, see that the president is going to have to, at least take on a tone of seriousness and address Afghanistan a little more directly to the public and at least make them aware that what's going on over there is serious, that there is a lot going on, and it seems to be a neglected area by the media and the public perception as well?
Craig?
I think you're right. I wrote this book in part to help people better understand this country, this part of the world that is of critical importance to us. I do think that I know that President Obama recognizes the seriousness of the area. He's identified as his top national security priority, and is in the midst of a 60-day review to make sure that these forces that will begin flowing in later this spring and over the course of the summer have a strategy and the resources they need to complete their mission. And I think part of this review is, how do we leverage all of our levers of power? Not just the military, but how do we get our other government agencies involved in a more effective way in Afghanistan? How do we mobilize our international partners who may be reluctant to send military forces, but could and should provide more non-military resources to Afghanistan? And I think it's going to take some time to educate the American public about that area. I think this book is a part of that, and I think President Obama will use the so-called bully pulpit to help Americans understand the gravity of the situation and to get us ready for a long and difficult slog. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be fast. And if you think back to 2 years ago in Iraq, when all looked hopeless, we somehow turned around the situation. And I take great comfort in one of General Petraeus's sort of proverbs. He said, hard is not hopeless. And America is a strong country, and we can make something of this. We can turn the situation around if we try.
Hard is not hopeless. That sounds like an Obama line. Todd in Buffalo, thank you very much for your call. I'm going to get one more real quick from Guy in Naples. Guy, we've just got half a minute. What do you say? Naples, Florida.
Okay. Your comment about the watches and times is very reminiscent to me. I'm an old vet from the Vietnam era, and we used to hear then from, I don't know, Ho Chi Minh made the comment or whatever about... the VC, had the most valuable commodity of all, which was time. America had all the bombs and bullets, but they had time. Did you, during your tour, feel some of the frustration that I did in Vietnam, flying back into the Ashaw and rebombing, you know, old places that we'd been to before? That's my question.
Guy, thanks so much. Craig, we've got half a minute here. How do you respond to the Vietnam vet?
Thank you for your service. I did feel some of that. It was frustrating to know that we could only be in a village once every 6 months. And, you know, of all the things you can surge, you can't surge trust. And you can't treat Afghans like contestants in speed dating.
And yet, when you're coming through just every few months, that must be how it feels sometimes.
It is.
You headed on into the military world? Are you done? Are you retired for good? Is that the way it works?
I am retired for good. Although, you know, most people spend their time in uniform saying, you know, the last place I want to go is the Pentagon. Now I'm out of uniform, and that's where I want to go. So it's, and it feels good to trade the combat boots for the wingtips, and to tackle a problem not from a ground level, but at the 100,000-foot level.
Well,
and I think I can...
contribute something there. We'll be watching that. We're nearly out of time here. The new memoir is The Unforgiving Minute. Craig Mullaney, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.